Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the Solari Report Joe Klein, who is attorney, author, at one point chaired the largest hospice in Iowa, she's joined us several times in the Solari Report to talk about healthcare directives and healthcare proxies, as well as how to manage end of life. I don't think there's anyone more knowledgeable about negotiating and navigating the entire healthcare system than Joe. And so when she sent me her new book, The 60-Minute Guide to Health Literacy, I was very excited. We just did a Solari Report on why it's so important to be literate in how to navigate the healthcare system. And so this is a topic very near and dear to my heart. And having somebody of Joe's extraordinary experience and expertise ready to take it on, I thought, perfect. And I called her and I said, you know, Joe, one of the reasons I love your books is you start many of them with a description of why there is a real coming rush hour in the entire U.S. healthcare system. Nobody describes it better than you. So would you join us on the Solari Report to talk about what Joe has described as the coming perfect storm in healthcare. So, Joe, thank you so much for coming back to the Solari Report, and thank you so much for your books and good work. You're just doing just tremendous things that add so much value to people's lives.
Well, thank you, Catherine, and of course the same back to you. I mean, the public education, this is what it's all about. It's kind of a patient at a time is what we're doing here, and that's, I think, the only way to approach it. What I call, indeed, the perfect storm, some people call the wall that we're going to hit, and then sometimes you hear it called the demographic tsunami. But I call it a perfect storm because it really is coming together three things: our aging demographics in America, the dwindling financial and human resources in the healthcare sector, and then, unfortunately, our lack of health literacy as patients. And I look back and I say, okay, if this isn't the law of unintended consequences, you know, just after World War II, we were celebrating the end of the war, and the way we celebrated it was by growing the American family. And I know that there was no one sitting around at the time thinking, okay, but 70 years from now, we're going to have 100 million people that are entering the healthcare system in their golden years with chronic conditions and end of life, and what are we going to do then? And that's exactly what led to this. This is really all about the baby boomers and those births between 1946 and 64, which are now age 53 to 71, and between now and 2030, when the last boomers will enter the Medicare system, is really a crucial time in this country for us to prepare for those numbers and all these things coming together at the same time.
Right. And when you mentioned Medicare, I also want to add, if you were doing our annual wrap-up on the pension fund system, and if you look at the state and local and other pension fund systems, what you discover, in fact, is, you know, they have been funding regularly their pension requirements, and you can debate whether it's sufficient or not, but they haven't been funding their medical obligations. And so this is all going to hit the Medicare system one way or another. Everything's going to collapse into it.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that the trustees who come out with their report have now pushed forward that date that Medicare is projected to be insolvent, and I know that's kind of a nebulous term because it's not solvent now, but it's going to be officially insolvent in 2028, which is 2 years earlier than they had predicted in their 2015 report. So they've already brought it 2 years closer to us. And when you look at the Medicaid situation, and I know every state is approaching this differently, we're learning some very tough lessons here in Iowa, having privatized and I don't even hear people, Catherine, what concerns me most, I don't even hear people talking about the age-related Medicaid issues, which, of course, is where the funding for folks who end up without assets and end up needing nursing care, that's where that money comes from. And I'm not even hearing them talk about that element of the storm.
Right. So why don't you tell us, where do you want to start? How do we describe this perfect storm?
Well, I think starting always with the demographics, because you know, throughout our lives, and you and I are boomers, we, you know, we've run into this and we've kind of learned to live with it. I mean, when we went to school, the schools were very crowded. Well, then they could build schools. And then when we wanted homes, there really weren't enough homes, so the prices soared, but we could wait for a house to be built. The difference is end-of-life, chronic illnesses and end-of-life, these are things that can't be put on hold. So when you talk about a 60% increase in the number of Americans age 65 and older by 2030, in the next 13 years, that's, of course, the people who are sick. I mean, as we get to be 65 and older, that's when we're going to have those chronic conditions. Three-quarters, 75% of Medicare patients have two or more chronic conditions. So they're constantly in the mode of being involved with the healthcare system, decision-making, at the same time that we are the sickest, because the oldest people are the sickest. Guess what? The boomers, who are also the patients, are also the providers. So that brings us to, now we start looking at the dwindling human resources. About a third of the healthcare industry's workers are about to retire. So we're looking at potentially a shortage of unfilled positions for 900,000 nurses and about 90,000 doctors in the next 10 to 15 years. And those are the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics figures. Those are not, you know, a trade organization or the boogeyman. That is the government who's admitting that we have this huge, they will just be unfilled positions. So if you've been in a care facility recently, imagine it, reimagine it with twice as many patients and half as many workers. That's really the reality of what's coming.
Now, it's interesting, when I was spending a fair amount of time out in Silicon Valley when Obamacare passed, and I had one software developer tell one of my colleagues at the time that they were planning on re-engineering $1.6 trillion of labor out of healthcare. And in fact, I just...
They've been pretty successful at that.
Right. Well, if you talk to the venture capitalists, they really believe they can replace 100% of all current employees on any function, including healthcare, with robotics and AI within some reasonable period of time.
Yeah, that's when you hear those things, you just think, boy, I hope not in my backyard, because that's, you know, that's not a realistic position to take, and it's not going to be a viable healthcare professional who's going to say that. It's going to be a social engineer who says that, because no doctor would ever tell you that or believe that. I was just poking around today on the web and found an organization. I thought, who are they? What is it they're doing? And discovered that I very quickly on a 10-second search discovered that they've recently received over $5 million in federal funding to study ways to increase longevity in America. And I thought, okay, well, that's not a bad thing, and it's certainly a good thing if we could increase a quality life for people and have them live longer and healthier. But really, if we're focusing on keeping people alive longer, then we should also be focusing on how we're going to take care of them while they're here. And that's my fear, is that we really are approaching a humanitarian crisis, that if there really are no workers there to check that patient in that bed, what happens to that patient? And what happens when you have to wait so long for a medical procedure that you don't live long enough to have it? I think those are realistic. I know I have friends who live in parts of the country that are very dominated with older population, and they're already experiencing this. You know, they have an incident, some sort of a neurological incident that ends in the ER, and it takes them 6 weeks to get into a neurologist and have an MRI. 6 weeks.
Well, right. So here's what I'm seeing. I'm seeing a split in the population between people who've made an effort to really learn how to navigate both natural health, preventative health, and the healthcare system. And they know how to get the best of both. You know, so they will do everything they possibly can themselves or with natural health practitioners, And as a result, they don't need a lot from the current system. But when they need it, they're very savvy about figuring out what they need and getting the best, or providing for emergency, you know, to make sure somebody's there in an emergency situation. So they're very savvy about doing it. And what's amazing is they get great results.
Yeah.
And then you'll see people, yeah, they get great results. And
yeah.
Because they know how to, you know, they are a very sophisticated shopper and they plan way ahead. They network, they plan ahead.
Yeah, you've just defined health literacy, which
right.
is really taking that responsibility for your own knowledge. And people kind of, you know, when I use that term, before they really understand what I mean, they're kind of like, oh, no, I don't want to learn everything about my healthcare problem. No, no, no. I don't want you to be a healthcare expert. That is the job of the healthcare provider. What I want you to be an expert in is gathering information and knowing where to look and knowing how to access and use the information to make informed decisions. They're starting to do, finally, some studies on how they can help people be more health literate and using what we're calling navigators. Sometimes they're called case
right.
coordinators. Sometimes they're called case managers or care coordinators that are really kind of assigned to you when you're in the healthcare system. But they're there to make sure you understand what the doctor just said and to make sure you understand your options. And are we going for treatment or are we going for cure? Or are we going for symptom control? And gosh, Catherine, they're finding in very short order, they're cutting ER visits down by 25%. They're cutting rehospitalizations down by 50%. I mean, this has an immediate and drastic effect on the quality of the healthcare life of the patient, which, hey, it saves money too. So the thing, we don't have the money to do that, doesn't make sense, because in the end game, it's a huge, huge cost savings to have an educated patient. I know it's discouraging and it's downright frightening in many parts of this country to access healthcare, but I'm with you. My friends, I call the 2% Club, are pretty savvy about their own healthcare and the people they're caring for, and guess what? They get good healthcare.
Right.
You know, I think it's kind of an analogous to when people said, well, I don't know, I heard that teacher's not very good. And I've always observed that when my friends whose child ended up in a class where the teacher was not very good, the kid did just fine because the parents were really good. And
so,
the parents
so let me just
stayed on top
mention
of
this.
It.
One of the things, one of the reasons we just did the Salieri Report, it's about 2 or 3 months ago on healthcare literacy, was I ran into a situation with a couple. I was talking with a husband whose wife was absolutely being killed by the medical system. She was being churned. She was being, you know, I mean, it's the things you can see are frightening.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going bankrupt, financing her complete brainwashed. You know, she just went in, got whoever she got, and started doing whatever they told her. And she was clearly with somebody who wasn't competent, and she clearly wasn't doing the things she could do to support building up her own immune system or detox or all the different, you know, so she wasn't doing her part, and she was just blind faith following somebody who was killing her, and it was bankrupting her husband, and he was in a complete state of panic. But of course, one of the problems is you can't learn this. You know, it's like turning an aircraft carrier. You got to learn it years before you need it.
Yes, you have to have a plan. Yeah.
Right, you have to have a plan, but you it takes a lot of research to get that plan. It's not so easy. So
and the other thing I've discovered, and I know since you've read the book that you heard my true confessions, that the legal profession and the healthcare profession for 40 years since the case of Karen Ann Quinlan in 1976, have been telling people that you really need to concentrate on that decision-making you might have to make at the very end of life. Advanced care planning is what we call it, you know, and that's the advanced directives, living wills, durable powers of attorney. And I've been, you know, the leader of the parade. But now I see the reality for our population and for us as individuals are these chronic conditions which require ongoing medical decision-making, and maybe 25% of us are going to be faced with that ventilator or feeding tube yes or no decision for ourselves or on behalf of someone else. But we're all going to be facing the decisions where the practitioner comes in and says, I have some bad news. And people always tell me, the problem wasn't at the end of life. The problem started the day the doctor walked in and said what the diagnosis was. And we took a wrong turn that day, and we kept going down the wrong path for months or years or whatever, because they didn't understand their rights as patients. They didn't understand the options. They didn't understand the goal of the treatment plan. And so they really were never making informed decisions anywhere along the path.
Right. Right. And it's difficult because everybody's different. The other thing is, if you look at your options, the only people who can make those decisions as to which options you take is you, because there are risks either way you go. And you've got to be prepared to take responsibility to which risks you want to take.
Yes, so, and to understand when those risks are presented to you, how probabilities really work, and when they quote those numbers to you, what those really mean, and to not leave a practitioner's, a healthcare provider's office until your questions have been answered, until you really do understand. I am hearing anecdotally, which just recently, it seems like an epidemic of people telling me about medical decisions being made for them without any consent being given at all.
They're
getting a phone call that says, Mrs. Smith, we got your biopsy in and you're scheduled to start chemo on Thursday. And Mrs. Smith says, you know what, I think I'd like to sit down and talk to an oncologist before I made that decision. And they've literally scheduled the patient for the treatment without even knowing what the patient's treatment goals are, and without the patient understanding, are you talking about we're going to cure my cancer, or are you just treating symptoms, or is this palliative care, or why are we doing chemo? But they have literally already scheduling them. I have a friend whose mother is fairly advanced dementia and was hospitalized for an acute condition, and ran into the doctor who was her hospitalist during hospitalization, which is a whole other topic. And he just said to her casually, oh, by the way, I noticed that your mom's on a really high dose of, you know, fill-in-the-blank medicine for dementia. I've lowered that. That's way too high. And my friend said, you did what? I have been working to get her regulated on that for several years. This is the dosage she needs to have some quality of life. You need to not be messing with that, and you need to go back and reverse that order.
Actually, I had a grandmother, a step-grandmother, who was killed by medical malpractice. She was a morphine addict. She had very serious arthritis pain, and she was, you know, it was managed, and it was all, you know, it was her doctors, and she was stable. She went in for elective surgery that she really needed to have, but the doctors, without discussing it with her doctors or her family, switched her to methadone because taking morphine was immoral, and she needed to be she needed to be weaned off of it. So they gave her methadone and it killed her.
And then we have the flip side, Catherine, of people whose pain is not being treated at the end of their lives because our providers are so paranoid about people becoming opioid addicted. And at the end of life, without opioids, we have a problem in this country. And as Dr. B.J. Miller, I heard him speak not long ago, said, you go to a country where they don't have opioids and watch the end of life and understand their place in our practice. There is a place for them. So, you know, that's the lack of, it's two things. It's not the provider not knowing the patient, not taking the time to get to know that patient's story and what their own personal goals and treatment goals are. And it's a patient and or their proxy decision makers who are not stepping in and being responsible decision makers and insisting on being involved in the process and being fully informed before they make a choice.
Well, I would say it this way. I would say that modern medicine is very powerful, and you better have equal or superior power in understanding it and knowing how to access it and what's good for you, because everybody's unique, everybody's different. So, you know, and that requires an education, Joe, that has to start before you need it.
Yes, long before, because advanced care planning isn't about just end of life. Advanced care planning is me making sure that all my medications are written down. You know, we have an issue in this country known as polypharmacy, which is that our 65 to 84-year-olds in America are taking an average of 14 to 18 prescriptions in a year's time. Well, if they're getting them from
different... No wonder they're sick.
No kidding. They're getting them from different prescribers. They're getting them from different pharmacies. They're not being coordinated. We have interactions. We have non-use. We have misuse, which is resulting in, we believe, an unreported leading cause of death in the elderly from falls and loss of independence and frailty and dementia-like symptoms, which actually are side effects from drugs. And I really encourage people, a one step they can take is anybody they know that uses multiple medications, make sure that they have what we call a brown bag checkup, which is at least once a year you gather up all the drugs, including the over-the-counters and the supplements, you put them in a brown bag, you take them either to your primary care provider or to your pharmacist, lay them out and say, tell me what's going on here. Why am I taking these? Do they go together? Do I have a problem? Am I taking them right? And get that all laid out, and you might be surprised what gets taken off the table or replaced. I mean, people are having side effects from drugs they're taking for side effects for other drugs, and they don't even have the condition anymore. So
right.
4 billion prescriptions are filled every year in this country. We're drug crazy, and thank God we've got a lot of them. But their misuse and their non-use, now we have a whole new specialty called de-prescribing, which is trying to figure out how to get people off of prescriptions that are no longer good for them, but now we need to wean them. So there's we've created many of these problems by our over, you know, medicating and over-providing medical practice. But you've said it so well, Catherine. This has to start long before the crisis comes. You have to have a decision-making process in place, a substitute decision-maker, and a commitment to be an informed patient.
Right. And you know something that it's easier to do now? If you look, there's just been, in the last 10 years alone, a wonderful number of documentaries, a wonderful number of books. There's been a real outpouring, and the internet has made this much easier to get all the information.
Yeah.
I had a cousin who got cancer and ran into doing the wrong things and called me, and I said, okay, you know, here are your choices. Here are the documentaries you need to watch. Here are the books you need to do. Here are the doctors who fit that thing. You know, but in the meantime, I'm going to call my favorite surgeon, you know, who is in your exact area and find out who the best person in your area is because you need to get to the right surgeon. So I was able to do that. But, you know, if he had had to go out and do that on his own, you know, it would have taken him, he didn't have the time to know what the best books and documentaries are, you know, his education. So he was lucky. He knew somebody who could help him sort of jump the curve on that. But that's why, I don't understand why they don't teach this in high school, to be perfectly honest.
Okay. I don't understand why they don't teach us in medical school.
Touche.
You know, our doctors take very, very little time in medical spent on the subject of shared decision-making, which is sitting down, getting to know that patient, giving options that work towards that patient's goals, making decisions, discussing it, and then making informed decisions. But I like your example really well because it is that combination of, hey, the internet is great, and it is. But you know what's great, too? Calling a friend and saying, hey, didn't you have somebody in your family that had this disease or this condition? Who did you use, and were you happy with them, and would you recommend them? That getting recommendations from your primary care physician, I want to know who you would send your family member to, doctor, not who may or may not be someone in your practice. And when you ask a doctor who's honest with you, I asked one of my specialists last year, I wanted to change primary care physicians, and I asked my specialists, as I happened to see them, who would you recommend, and discovered that I had specialists who were seeing, as their own private doctor, doctors other than in the network they were in. And I appreciated their honesty. And the fact that they were willing to admit that they preferred this other doctor as opposed to one of their partners, and narrowed down my choices between that and friends, and saying, I got this list here. You know, so you're doing the great combination of the technology, which is unbeatable these days, what we can research online, and the old-fashioned, who do you like, who did you see, who does a good job?
Well, it's funny, when I was a kid, my father was a very famous surgeon and was passionate about saving people. That he lived to, you know, save the impossible, you know, the case that was hopeless. Anyway, but they had a list of doctors that doctors send their kids to. Who are the doctors that doctors go to? And he was always proud because he always made the list. But you know, one of the things he would do is he would sit at the dinner table, and you always wondered what happened that day, and basically scream into us that number one, you know, we always had to find the doctor the doctors go to, but number two, whenever we were in a hospital, we had to watch what was going on, and he would always beat into us, never get general anesthesia. If you can get local, I want you to have local. Why, Daddy? Because I want you to watch what's going on.
Yes. And so, I tell people nowadays, if you're in the hospital, you must really be sick, which means that you need to have an advocate with you, preferably 24 hours a day, but certainly all your waking hours, so that when a nurse comes in and says, you say, why are you here? I'm here to give them their meds. Really? Because somebody was just in here 10 minutes ago and gave them their meds. And those are the
kind
of things that...
It's why I got you on the Salary Report as many times as I did, because one of my friends died in 2010, and her niece and I, between us, we had control of both the money and the healthcare proxy, and we backed each other up. We were like two timers, and she was incredible in terms of navigating the bureaucracy, and I was great in terms of all the law and money, and the two of us together were killers. We were like foo dogs. And I can't tell you how many times, Joe, they tried to do something highly unethical or illegal or immoral, or, you know, it was just appalling. And I felt like, you know, I felt like I was navigating hostile territory. Now, in the system, there were fabulous, wonderful doctors and nurses and wonderful people. So there was plenty of wonderful stuff going on, too. But, you know, somebody had to be in charge, and she couldn't be. She was just out.
Right. Well, and we are our own worst enemy in many ways. I mean, we have relied on the paternalistic model for many decades, where we just did what the doctors told us to do, and we trusted them. And you and I both know that the great, great majority of them, I'll say 95% of them, are wonderful, caring, competent, compassionate providers. But now we've put them in a machine where they can only see us for 15 to 20 minutes. My own doctor breaks that rule, and that's why he's my doctor. But, you know, by the model, by the business model, they don't have a lot of time like doctors used to have for us, and we have put them into the business model where their patients are now, as I say, you know, the day I turn 65, you know, my providers start crying because they know that they're going to get probably 50, 40 to 60% reimbursement as opposed to when I was on private insurance.
Right.
When I had a rotator cuff surgery last year, and I said to my surgeon, I said, you know, I was on private pay when I had the surgery done. Now I'm having the PT under Medicare. And he goes, God bless you, Joe, because he knows he made probably twice as much for that surgery than he would have made if I'd waited 30 days to have it. So we hamstring them. And then we wonder why they don't have time for us. And that's when the advocate comes in, the second set of ears, whether it's an appointment buddy who goes with you to any appointment, or certainly when you think there's something important that's going to be discussed, you get that relative on the smartphone sitting on the table. You ask the doctor, do you have any objection if my daughter is on the speakerphone? And they're not going to say they object. Why would they object? And you've got another set of ears and questions, and a person who says, you know, Mom, we need to talk about this, and can we get back to the doctor tomorrow? I mean, it's okay to say that. You don't have to make a decision on the spot. But it's having that system in place ahead of time that makes you an informed patient. You know, there's a group of Americans, a growing group of Americans called elder orphans, and we estimate about one in five Americans 65 and older have no one. They have no family member, and they have no friends who are willing and able to act as their advocate. And those are the people I really worry about. They get into the healthcare system, there is no one there to be a decision maker for them in a crisis. And our laws are not structured to provide for them.
That is a really serious problem. It's going to get more serious.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. The older we get, the fewer friends and family we have.
Right.
I mean, the last one left is going to be a sole decision maker. And our laws, number one, are entirely geared toward blood family. If you see what states call proxy by statute laws, where if I don't have directives, someone gets to step in. Very, very few states, only about four states, recognize unrelated parties to be those decision makers. So that's why that paperwork has a place for sure, but it is more likely to be used long before your end of life.
Right. Right. Okay, so we've looked at demographics. We've looked at the changing or the challenge of healthcare providers as the boomers retire. What other scary things do you have in your pouch?
Well, that you know, the finances, and you don't even hear them talking about it, and that's what's worried me. You know, when we went to kindergarten, they said, "Where'd these 5-year-olds come from?" And we said, "Well, you know, remember us? We were born 5 years ago." And they hurried up and built grade schools, but then 10 years later, hey, where'd all these high school kids come from? This is what you don't hear them. It's the knock, knock, knock at the door. Hey, where'd all you old baby boomers come from? They're not talking about this, but Obamacare cut hospice reimbursements by 10%.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yes, yes. And yeah, I mean, that's like taking 1 year out of the decade of the budget for hospice care. We only spend 3% of the Medicare budget on hospice care, but we spend a fourth of the Medicare budget on people's last year of life. So what are we doing? Well, we're spending 80% of the budget on people that have four or more chronic conditions. So instead of addressing preventive care or healthy lifestyles, we just keep throwing more money at it. And we're running out of money, and I don't have to tell you that. And they're not accounting for the fact that we're going to have this twice as many people over 85 in not very many years, twice as many as we have now.
So let's talk economics, because I think economic problem number one is not the healthcare system, it's the food and environmental pollution. So, you know, if you want to lower the cost of chronic disease, you have to take away the environmental pollution and the poor food choices that are leading to that disease.
And you have to start with education, of course, with patient education.
Well, I think it's more than education, because if you look at both the environmental pollution and the what I would call the corporatization of the food system in a way that really lowered the quality, that one is, you can solve the problem if you're wealthy and have plenty of time to deal with it. But I think for most people, you know, that is a real problem emanating from the corruption of government and government's failure to do the right thing. So,
and
I mean, it's
how do we fix that? And how do we fix that in time for these, you know, these 75 million people that are already into the system? I mean, that's my fear.
Right.
Is there enough time to even do it? Is the system too broken to be fixed? I don't know.
Well, there are many things that can be done, but they all start with doing what you have the power to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is, if most people took responsibility to push back as consumers, that's where you're making real changes. So, it is going to have to come down to the individual citizen saying, you know, I'm not eating that crap, and you need to, you know, we need to do something here. It's funny, I just put up a video from Melissa Dykes called Why I Talk About the Truth. And she talks about she was 28 years old and constantly sick. And she dug in and figured out, okay, you know, I'm not, this food that I think is food is not really food. So I need to radically change my diet, which she did, and went to much more fresh and, you know, was selective about you know, no GMOs, et cetera, and got really healthy. And that's when she said, well, what else? You know, what other things are going on? So there's a great deal everybody can do. And I think you're never too old to do it. So, I mean, we're just going to have to focus there. But I do think you're, if you wanted to radically improve the healthcare economics, you're going to have to deal with the front end. A second thing is, you know, to me, the pharmaceutical industry is out of control. If you go to Canada, New Zealand, Mexico, I know a group of people in LA who get in the car once a month and drive down to Mexico for lunch and get all their meds for 10% of what they're paying, you know, if they got them in LA. So, you know, the second thing is you've got to bust the pharmaceutical cartel and, you know, because, you know, whether it's the amount of drugs we're taking or the prices that are being charged relative to other countries around the world, it's just a joke. I mean, it's a...
But again, you come and you see the effect on all that system of the agent, because more and more of the users of those drugs, of course, are coming, they're being paid for through Medicare. I mean, they're being paid for by my Medicare policy and my supplemental, my Part D. And that's where that control is all starting, is because they're the ones who set the formulary. They're the ones who decide how much is going to get paid for each of those drugs that I'm on.
Third thing about the economics is, I'll just be blunt, we need health care. We don't need health care insurance. You've, by turning this into a financial product, you've added a huge layer of regulation, complexity, and expense, which I think has really detracted from... you know, because now a doctor is, you know, a doctor in any situation is overlaid with so much risk related to the laws and the regulation and the insurance company and this and that. It's just mind-boggling. And
well, the Medicare budget is about $600 billion a year, and the healthcare industry estimates that it costs them $250 billion a year for what they need to do to comply with the Medicare system.
Good
so
Lord.
Almost well over a third of the same amount as the Medicare budget is being spent just to make it possible, just to keep the clock ticking. And then when you throw in, we estimate probably $200 billion a year in medication-related healthcare issues. So we've caused the healthcare issue by a medication being given, not given, misused. And then we throw in $200 billion a year that are probably due to lack of health literacy. You know, as Everett Dirksen would say, we got some pretty serious numbers here, a billion here and a billion there. We can't sustain this. And as I wrote this last book, I really had to stop and do some soul searching and say, who is my audience? Because I've really tried to be, you know, convert people for 11 years with my writing on end-of-life decision-making and healthcare advanced directives, and now I'm kind of not doing that anymore, to be honest with you, Catherine. I want to preach to the choir. I mean, I want to preach to the people who say, I want to know how to do this, tell me how to do this, and I will say, then I will tell you how. But I can't spend any more time trying to convince people to be responsible for themselves. Because if they don't see what's coming, that big dark thing there, that's a wave, that's a tsunami coming. And it is going to come, and it is going to be, I'm afraid, one of the darkest hours in our country's history, because how we are judged, how we take care of our most vulnerable, and our most vulnerable are the ones who will suffer horribly if we don't get some answers right away. And we're not even asking the questions
so
on a national level.
Let me ask a couple of questions about what I see as possible, different kinds of solutions that can help ease the wall. One is, I had to laugh, I think it was 2 years ago, it was right in the middle of the intense discussion implementation of Obamacare. It was, I don't know if you heard my line, but in the first month after Obamacare, more people signed up for a one-way trip to Mars than signed up for Obamacare, which I thought was pretty funny. Anyway, it's so interesting.
And the chances of succeeding were exactly the same, too.
Anyway, but a surgical center of Oklahoma came out and announced that for a list of fairly common surgeries, that first of all, they were only taking cash, and they would do those surgeries for 20% of the Medicare schedule. I don't know if you saw that. Yeah, but that, they were saying if we can just do cash and leave that whole thing behind, that's how economic it is. That's my theory. If we were ready for cold turkey, if we just woke up and said, okay, everybody pay cash, you know, within 5 years, we'd be much better off. Obviously, the first year would be very painful. So,
well, and there certainly are some segments who have figured that out, the concierge providers. Right. Who have said, give us X number of dollars to be a member of our, to belong to this clinic, and you will get an annual, and you will get priority service. You'll actually get an appointment. And for those of you who don't pay the membership fee, get in line.
Right. Which I think is a great idea, because that gives them...
It works
them...
well for the people who have the money
right.
to pay the concierge
right.
membership.
Right.
But that's how those clinics have addressed that issue. They said, you know what, we're just going to eliminate a lot of this. We're not turning that annual physical into Medicare anymore and going through the paperwork. We're giving them a deal. You're going to get this, and you're going to get a certain number of visits and a certain number of hours with our practitioners, and that's what you're getting for your membership, and they're not even going through Medicare.
So then what about the there's an explosion we're seeing of software development and apps and other things to make, for example, testing much cheaper and much lower cost and much more accessible. So that, in fact, somebody who's willing to take responsibility and do it yourself has a lot more potential tools at their, available to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it no matter what the technology, and I speak to that a little bit in my book about the technology of being your own record keeper and how to do that. You know, of course, all of our doctors are going on the patient portal system and all that, and that's fine. And when you get down to genome testing and really sophisticated, you know, brain scans and the things that we can now do, PET scans and things that we couldn't do, I mean, you know, just a few years ago. It always still, Catherine, comes down to that patient who says, what is the end game here? Whether I have the technology to find this out or we're using the old-fashioned method or we don't know for the condition I have, what's wrong, what are my options and what are my personal goals before I decide if I want that fancy test? And the other problem we're going to have, and we're already seeing it, is, quite frankly, the rationing of those resources. Because there are limited dollars, and we are going to say, I'm sorry, your mom doesn't get that sophisticated test because she's fill-in-the-blank years old, and it just is not a good investment of Medicare dollars to give her a new hip so that she can have another 5 years of quality life. We just don't see it. And that's already happening. Of course it's happening. It happens any time a doctor sits a family down and says, your loved one is not a prospect for this procedure. It's medically futile. It doesn't make sense to do it.
Now, one of the things I'm watching is a significant number of people moving to live abroad because the healthcare system is much more economic or much more human. And there's a growing body of sort of expertise and knowledge of, you know, sort of where it is attractive to live in the world to avoid this wall by going to a place where the wall's not so high or so big. Or the resources are there, or it's a much lower cost area, so you can afford to deal with that wall. And so I'm seeing healthcare as arguably the primary or one of the primary drivers in sending people offshore.
If there is any hard statistics on that, I'm not aware of them, and I haven't been looking for them, so they may well be out there. So I can't really speak to that. I guess I. That's a sad commentary, isn't it? If people have to make a move like that, that really is the only reason that they're doing it, then clearly we're already in deep trouble, and we are in deep trouble. But if we're driving people out of our country with the resources here, it's not that we don't have the resources. It's not that we don't have the talent or the people or the money or the advancements. None of those. It's not that we don't have those things. We just don't seem to be able to get our act together on how to use them properly and make them available to everybody.
Well, I think when I see that happen, it's part of a decision to move to a low-cost area. So I live in Hickory Valley, Tennessee, because it's a low-cost area.
Mm-hmm.
I have three properties here, and my combined local and county property taxes on those three properties are $500 a year. So I was really worried that property taxes would skyrocket. You know, if you doubled mine, what's that? It's $1,000 a year.
I'm
okay?
Sorry. In Iowa, I'm sitting here in a house where my right. property taxes are $500 a month.
Right. Well, that, I mean, that's one of the reasons. The other thing is, you know, the pension funds here are fully funded. So I was looking for somebody where if you looked at the state and local government finances, that you were unlikely to get a big surprise financially. So, but so there are low cost areas people can move to in the United States, but a lot of the decisions are twofold. One is they're looking for a low cost area. But the second thing is, you know, and that includes health. Health is a big part of the budget that concerns them. But the other thing is they're looking for more human culture because, you know, I think part of the problem is the healthcare system is very powerful. If you walk in and it's not human, I mean, that's what I dealt with when Georgie died. I was dealing with a system which was designed to be inhuman. Now, many of the people in it were wonderful and very human, but the system itself, between the government insurance and the finances, had really become inhuman. And so
let me ask you this. With your advocacy and the advocacy of the person that you partnered with to be there for Georgie, did you feel at the end of the day that you were able to maximize that system's benefits for Georgie because of your advocacy and because you took charge, that you were able to make it work for her?
Yes, and that took a tremendous amount of time and effort on our parts, which we were happy to do.
Expertise. And many years, but you didn't learn that the day you walked into the job. You had done your homework all your lives. Yeah.
But the number one thing we did right was we got her into hospice at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And if we hadn't done that, it would have been inhuman.
Almost half of the people in America now die in hospice, 43%. But the average number of days, well, the median days is about 17, but more often than not, people go into it way, way, way too late, and so they don't receive the full benefits of having hospice address that comfort issue and address the loved ones' issues with end of life of the patient. And it's or palliative care. We could spend a whole report talking about palliative care because palliative care is so misunderstood in America. And it's a large element of hospice, but palliative care is comfort care for any serious disease. Amazing studies being done where they start cancer patients out. One group has palliative care from the get-go. The other one just has oncology. And guess what? At the end of their lives, and they know that these are non-curable terminal cancers, at the end of their lives, the ones with palliative live 25% longer.
Wow.
Yes.
I never heard that statistic. Yeah, that's amazing.
It's in the book. I'll shoot you over an email and tell you the page to find it. It's, Massachusetts General study. But fascinating because guess what? When the palliative care doctor was focusing on the comfort issues, the side effects of the disease and the side effects of the treatments, the oncologist could focus on treating the disease. And they weren't spending any of the energy or time working on shortness of breath or anxiety or depression or any of the fatigue, any of the things that came along with the oncology. 25% longer they lived. So longer lives, higher quality lives, just because we reintroduced what used to be part of the practitioner's job but is now a specialty, comfort care.
One of the things that I find very intriguing is I've been watching some of the different websites or people who are crowdfunding their diagnosis. So on these, you know, you get these situations where people really have a hard time figuring out what the world's wrong. And that's where I really feel the software and the online services.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it help a lot of people because they get in there and they, you know, they start networking, and especially on something which is, you know, not common.
Mm-hmm.
It's unusual. It's a disease that it's a rare situation, and they get incredible results where it works. It doesn't always work.
Mm-hmm. Software that is being introduced in the healthcare industry itself for doctors to use, which is basically plugging in all the symptoms, and now we can plug in so many other things. and popping up with. Now, I'm always going to want a human being to interpret this.
I am too. I would much rather
have the doctor have access.
That's right, because I always say I'm looking for one thing in my doctor. Are they a good diagnostician? Because that's really the key to success there. Can they look at the overall picture and say, I think this is what we're looking at? But we do have these incredible tools at our fingertips. I mean, you and I could do so much more research before we even go to the doctor, probably more than we should, before we finally break down and see the professional. But that's what I mean. The resources are all there. This is a matter of access and prioritizing.
Right.
And that's what we have upside down generally in this system
right
now.
Well, it's funny that, and I did this because of I was involved in very sort of political litigation. And so to this day, you know, whenever I fill out a form and it says, who is your doctor, who is your primary caregiver, I write none. And the reason I write none is because if I put a name there, that will legally give that person decision-making authority in times and moments when I don't want them to have it, or even if I trust them, I don't want them to be pressured by anything political. So I'm really careful that way.
And you bring up a point which I alluded to a little early, and if we have a minute, I want to mention this.
Please.
We do talk about, you know, having these conversations with our primary care physicians and that relationship, which is so very, very important, of having a primary care physician that you trust and that will tell you the truth and will be there for you, will be your number one advocate. But people, I don't know how many people realize that when you actually have to go to the hospital for something, whether it's unexpected or planned, chances are your primary care physician is not going to be attending you in that hospital.
Right.
Because the great majority of hospitals in this country are now using hospitalists, which are, they can be of two types. They can actually be employees of the hospital, or they can be outside practices that specialize in simply going to the hospital and treating the patients of other doctors or those who have no doctors. And there's that stranger who walks in the room, and they don't know if you just came from your own home that you're living in independently or you just came from a nursing facility. And that's the importance of that advocate at your side who can tell your story if you no longer, either temporarily or permanently, have the capacity to advocate for yourself. Because you may well be dealing with a stranger. Or if not, Catherine, if it's not the hospitalist, it's going to be the emergency doctor or the intensivist or the specialist who's never met you before.
Right.
And making sure that they know your story and know your medical history and know what your personal goals are and beliefs and values and your preferences and your priorities, those are key to them giving you options for care that really match you and that it give your decision maker or you, if you still can, options that fit your situation, not the guy in the bed next door to you, but you. Those are so unique.
We have a great Salieri report on healthcare directives and healthcare proxies with you, but you always recommend forms that people can use to do their planning, and I would just ask that you do that. Is there something you can recommend today?
Well, I actually drafted my own form last year. So if they go to my website, which is joekline.net, so it's joekline.net, you will see there an advanced directives click through, or they can just go to advance-directives.net. And those are the forms that I drafted last year. I have looked at so many forms over the years, and many states are using forms that are 40 years old. They are done, you know, post-Quinlan and post-Cruzan, where we were worried about vegetative states, and that's not really what's going on now. We need to be worried about the process of decision-making. So I really focus on that in my form, which is, Catherine, here's how I want you to make a decision for me in any healthcare situation that I'm not able to participate. So here's whether or not we're talking about a feeding tube or we're talking about whether or not to, you know, give me stitches after a car accident. And then the other thing is that we have not dealt with the number six killer of all Americans and the number three killer of Americans over 75, which is dementia.
Right.
And those are not addressed in typical advanced directives where people are saying, hey, I know one thing. When I don't know anything about what's going on around me, I don't want you to keep me around anymore. That's not a terminal condition, and that's not irreversible unconsciousness until the very late stages. And so it makes it so difficult for loved ones. What do I do now? Because they don't really qualify for me to not give them a feeding tube or not give them
right.
a ventilator or not treat their pneumonia.
Right.
So I thought it was important to make that a third category in my advanced directive. So I have my own forms now, and I have a multi-state form and an Iowa version, but they can go to that site and see which states
fabulous.
They don't work. And there's four or five states you can't use them in, but generally they're
right.
They work anywhere.
So I just have to say that, you know, Georgie, my friend who died in 2010, had been in the Navy and ran, you know, Navy contracts. So she was tough. And she made me sit down and go through her healthcare proxy and plan this all out. And I kept saying, Georgie, I don't want to talk about this. This is gruesome. This is bad. This is horrible. This is, you know. But Georgie, I lived with her through several surgeries and sort of helping her manage the whole process from the time she got cancer. She lived for a very long time, and she lived much, much longer because she had a bunch of trained food dogs watching out for her. And the thing that made us powerful beyond anything, Joe, was we had very clear direction from her. We were totally confident that we knew exactly what she wanted. And so that made us powerful, and she knew it would, but I didn't understand it, and she really had to beat me up and make me do it against my will, and now I understand. So
yeah,
so,
and the other important thing is that that is what your job is as a proxy, is to do what that person would do
right.
if they were able, not to do what you would do for yourself
right.
or what you think
right.
they should do. But what
right.
they would do if they could speak
right.
and had capacity, and there's only one way to do that, and Georgie knew that, and that was to have that conversation with you over and over and over again till you got it, so that
right.
there wasn't any doubt in your mind what she wanted you to do on her behalf.
Right, right. Okay, so I want to just take a moment, because one of your books is on ethical wills, and
mm-hmm.
I just had a remarkable experience. I came from a memorial service 2 weeks ago for my 94-year uncle, who was a remarkable human being, but he made an extraordinary effort after he turned 90 to kind of educate us as to his life, what he had learned, you know, what was in his legacy, in his character, in his culture, that he could teach us before he
wow.
went out.
What a
and,
gift.
He was an engineer. He has a PhD from MIT, and he managed, you know, he managed everything to a T, but he really managed to embody, organize, and communicate, not just intellectually, but emotionally to us, his legacy. And it's a legacy which for us, both in terms of our character, in terms of our sense of the world and of being loved in the world, of culture, is so powerful. I can't talk about it without crying. You can hear my voice get cracky. But
that
you know,
is a priceless, priceless treasure. And what a wonderful gift, what a generous person he was to take the time and the energy that it took to do that, to share that, so that you would have that piece of him always. I mean, that, and
well, the thing
there was
marvelous.
Things that you could only learn from him. There was no other way to learn that stuff.
Right. He sat down with me a couple months before he died, say 6 months, and I went to see him because I knew he was unhappy. His memory was slipping, and he's a very brilliant guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he sat down and he said, look, I'm planning on dying. I've had a great life, but my memory's going. I don't want to stay alive if my memory's going, so I'm going to die now. And I don't want you to feel bad about it. It's my decision, and it is what it, you know. So we kind of had our final check-in, if you will. And
mm-hmm.
then he proceeded to die. And I have no idea how many people. He swore me to secrecy. I wasn't allowed to tell anybody else. So he probably did it to 20 other people.
I love that.
Anyway, but at the you
and
know,
did
we
he
had
say,
a,
and you were my favorite, don't tell anybody else, but you were my
no,
favorite.
No, he would never do that. No, he wasn't, there was not a gaming bone in his body. No, he was.
But that's great
anyway,
that he did that. And maybe he did do that with 20 people. And what a gift
I bet he
for
did.
All 20 of you.
Well, but you walked into the funeral home. I mean, I'm sorry, it was a Quaker meeting. It was a Quaker meeting service. There was absolutely no unhappiness. You really had the feeling about Robin, his name was Robin Willetts, that he was like onto his next thing. He was always a very, you know, every gear was always in forward with Robin. But everybody was shimmering and glowing with the legacy that he had given them before he died.
Yes,
And,
and I'm guessing a man who lived with few regrets, and that's
very
always
few
a joyous
regrets.
occasion. Yeah,
Very,
and
very few.
ethical will, just very quickly for your audience, is an ancient Jewish tradition. The first one is in the Book of Genesis, and it is not a legal document. It is a statement of your beliefs and values, and your life
Right.
lessons, and your hopes for the future. And your uncle did that. Now, did he leave writings, or was this all just oral history that he shared with you?
No, he left a series both of audios
Oh,
and
wow.
written things that he shared with us. But so it was some was audio, some was written, but then some was shared intimately, like the conversation I had with him.
Wow.
And he really worked on it in his last 10 years, but particularly the last 4 or 5 years of his life. And but what was even better was then when we all met at Quaker service, everybody stands up and speaks as they're led to speak within a Quaker service. You had people who literally had come from a century of knowing Robin and our family, and who stood up and told story after story after story, and read different things or told different stories about Robin, and being there together and capturing all of that together, just solidified the power of this legacy. And I see your work on ethical wills is trying to explain to people, look, there is a major legacy that gets handed down. One of my favorite read a book review once about a great scholar in Mali. They said when he died, it was like a library burning down.
Wow.
And, we have to make sure as the boomers transition, that we and each family, the thing that makes a family powerful, among other things, is to know your history. And you know your history by this legacy getting passed down and down and down. And that legacy and knowing our history can really make us powerful. It's very powerful in terms of protecting us from financial fraud. And so, as we go through this process, there is, if we hit this wall and don't transfer that legacy, hitting the wall is going to be bad enough. Hitting the wall without the legacy transfer, everybody is going to end up, the next generations are going to end up powerless on the other side. We can't let that happen.
Well, it's a really good point, Catherine, because and I think the potential for that tragedy is there, because when all your energy needs to go on trying to figure out how you're going to take the next step in your healthcare story, you really don't have the time or energy to devote to talking about your legacy story. So yeah,
Right.
I fear that people will spend the last chapters of their lives doing nothing but being completely ensconced in the healthcare system and trying to get the care that they deserve but can't grasp onto. So yeah, the whole ethical will, whether it's a letter or a collection of quotations or highlighting your favorite verses in your favorite Bible or book or whatever it is, transferring the lessons we've learned, I mean, it just doesn't get any more priceless than that, because that's the only place you can learn those things is in the school of hard knocks.
Right. Right. It was really funny. One of my favorite moments was Robin until he stopped skiing when he was 85 because his wife was screaming at him. She didn't want him to. He had a couple of spills, but the guy who used to go skiing with him stood up and explained that Robin said he stopped skiing not because he thought he was going to get hurt. The problem was he couldn't trust himself not to ski fast.
Wow.
So I want to go out skiing fast, if you will. Okay, well, anything else, any other points you want to make about the wall and what's coming up? Anything else that can help us see that perfect
I
storm so we've
think
talked
what
about?
I'm really starting to see clearly is this is a it truly is a patient by patient solution, but it's also a provider by provider. So as I'm
Right.
talking to doctors and I'm talking to administrators, I'm saying, understand, you have the control right now. You have the power to change the system in your four walls of your institution or in the four walls of your examination room. You have that power. You don't need Congress to give you that power. You don't need the government to change a program or do one thing different. You can start by communicating with your patients and making sure that they understand when they walk out your door what their next step is and who's going to take it. When they're discharged from the hospital, what should they do next to take care of themselves? What should they should look out for? And as patients, the same thing. We don't have to wait for Washington to change things to get the health care that we need and deserve. We can be responsible for our own health literacy and make sure that we are informed patients and insist on exercising our right to informed consent and patient autonomy, which means really respecting our personal belief systems in the midst of the healthcare system. So I have great hope as I meet individuals, whether those are patients or providers or administrators, that there are many out there who want to make a change and they simply need to know how to do it. When I went to write this book, and it was a personal healthcare situation that led me to write this most recent book, I looked at, you know, what you do as an author, what I've always done because mine are nonfiction books, is to go look and see, well, what's the competition? Well, what's right. already out there? Guess what? There's nothing. I mean, I was just shocked.
Right, it's remarkable.
Realized, yeah, right. that the only health literacy books were written for practitioners, and quite frankly, they were 300- and 400-page tomes on how to dumb down their communication for us. Because that's the only way they can deal with, you know, we stupid patients is to minimize the language to us so that we get what's going on. And I couldn't disagree more. I don't think that has anything to do with our ability to understand. It has to do with our ability to feel empowered and to understand that as patients we have a right to understand what's happening with our health care, but we also have a responsibility to be an informed patient. And to not let the system make decisions for us. That's our right and our obligation to do that ourselves.
You know, I'll tell you a funny story. I decided I had to get radically simple about sort of everything I was doing in terms of healthcare, preventative healthcare. So I made a list of every therapy. I did a very serious detox after the litigation, and so it got me involved in trying a lot of things. Anyway, so I made a list of every therapy in the last 10 years anybody had advised, whether it was nutrition or, you know, all of them, all the old-timey remedies, everything a doctor advised, everything. I made a list, and I was trying to figure out what was the most effective. And I went through a whole sorting process and analysis, and you know what I realized was the most effective?
What?
You're going to laugh. Prayer. Because when I didn't know what to do, if I would just sit down and calm down and become much more coherent mm-hmm. and just pray about, you know, the sequence of what I should do, mm-hmm. I would make a much wiser decision.
I hear you and I agree with you. And I think, you know, that's that mind-body and spirituality right. connection that we have really, that there's where your technology, we become our own worst enemy because we become so dependent on our ability to do things. We have to stop and look and listen and say, yes, but what is the right thing for us to do? And we often don't have the answer to that question.
I have a tendency to jump to action. Yeah, I have a tendency to jump to action, and that's where I make my mistakes. Because, you know, I act on a symptom instead of sitting down and saying, okay, what's the real problem here?
And in defense of our healthcare providers, for, you know, decades and decades, our mantra has been, fix it, doc. Just fix it. Give me a pill. Right. Give me a procedure. Make me well. And when right. they hit their own wall and they know they can't do anything more, we leave them hanging there. And doctors will tell you, and there have been many studies done, they feel very disloyal to a patient who they have to say, I can't do anything for you. So they just keep doing stuff, even though right. they know that they're no longer curing. But many of us think they are trying to cure, and that's where that miscommunication comes in. So everybody kind of needs to take a deep breath and say, what's our end goal here? Because guess what, folks? None of us are getting out of here alive. The doctors, right. the patients, nobody is. It's coming to an end, and now we're talking about what goes between now and then.
Right. And one of my favorite lines is from the Gladiator. He says, "Give me a good death, a clean death."
That's right.
Well, I've been around a lot of people who've died very, very well. It's been a remarkable experience, leaving a great legacy for their whole family. And it can be done. And, you know, I go back and forth between many different cultures, and some cultures are totally open and talking, you know, death's just part of life, and yes, it's all open and everybody deals with it. And it's not a horrible thing. You know, in America, it's just like, oh, don't talk about that. That's horrible. You know, it's
yeah. And
it's
at the
so
same
strange.
Time in America, now one of every five Americans lives in a state where physician assisted suicide is legal. And it
right.
concerns me a great deal that people are thinking that, because they think that's a better alternative than what the healthcare system is going to offer them. And shame on us if that's what patients think, because
we have
a better way.
One last thing I want to bring up before we close, and this has been unbelievably useful, Joe, is all your books and all your conversations are. I'm really concerned. If you look at what's happening in the healthcare area, we're seeing an explosion of advancements, life extension, all these amazing things, only available to the very, very wealthy. And one of the things I'm afraid of is this wall you're describing, combined with those technological advances, means we're headed into a period where the inequality could become mind-boggling.
I think it's a potential humanitarian crisis. I don't think there's
right.
any question. When you have people in facilities where we do not have the worker to, first of all, we don't have the ability to say yes to procedures for certain populations, and we're going to be, you know, it's an easy way to cut off by age. That's just a real simple one. You know, you reach a certain age, I'm sorry, but you don't get any more procedures because
right.
you're past your use-by date, according to the Medicare chart. When we start doing that, or we start doing it by, oh, I'm sorry, you're over an hour away from the nearest clinic, well, then you can't really have this procedure because you're going to need to come, you know, every day for this treatment.
Right.
So if you don't have transportation and you're an hour away, then that's not going to work for you, is it? That day is coming. That day is definitely coming. And I think it's only through patient education, self-education, and people really trying to be health literate, where people are going to realize and not only take care of themselves, but now they start thinking about their neighbor and their loved ones and their family members and their friends, and going, you know what, I need to talk to them about this too, because I don't think they've made plans for this. And they're healthy right now, but what if that day comes? And you know, when it comes very quickly. It's always
right.
unexpected. That's kind of the definition of emergency, is it's unexpected.
Right.
And if you don't have that plan in place ahead of time of who's going to step in and who's going to be responsible for to be your advocate in that healthcare system, that will be a healthcare crisis for you, I guarantee. And if you multiply that times 75 million, it's a humanitarian crisis.
Okay, quick questions from a great subscriber. He starts off, I had an uncle decline cancer treatment, just skipped it and went into hospice care instead. He was at peace spiritually to make that decision. I think the comment, no torture, was used. So a first question is, do most healthcare directives suffice for skipping treatments?
Well, first of all, let's remember that a healthcare directive, which is really your advance instructions, only need to kick in at all if you can't make decisions.
Right.
So as long as you have capacity, and it sounds like this gentleman did, you get to make your own decisions. And the only time a healthcare directive should even be referred to is if you are incapacitated and can't make a decision, whether that's a temporary thing, you're under anesthetic, or it's a permanent incapacity like a dementia. So most directives, yes, they could definitely, but here's always the key to the directive is, has a triggering event occurred? Because that's when those no procedures, no antibiotics, no feeding tube, all those things kick in once a triggering event occurs. And traditionally, the triggering events have always been, I have a terminal condition, which means I'm very close to the end of death. Not just I'm going to die, but I'm very close to the end of death. Or I'm irreversibly unconscious. If it's one of those two things, then here's my instructions. I don't want treatment. I don't want to be hospitalized. I don't know what,
right.
you know, fill in the blank, whatever they are. But again, always, first of all, does the patient have capacity to make their own decisions? Because you know what? You don't have to have 100% capacity in your life. You don't have to be able to take care of yourself anymore or live alone. And you can still make medical decisions. People know right. to the very, very close to the end of life whether or not they want a feeding tube in them if they're conscious or whether they right. want a ventilator. So you will hear competent, compassionate doctors talking about all kinds of communication methods, which is putting a hand up or shaking a head or just looking like you're in pain when someone's trying to do something to you medically. But no, a no treatment would be in an advanced directive if indeed a triggering event had occurred. And it's that long time before then that really worries most of us, is maybe the months or years when I don't Right. know where I'm at and I don't know anybody, but I'm not terminal and I'm not irreversibly unconscious, so you all are going to feel obligated to keep me around. So that's why it's important to really understand what your directive says. Read it yourself.
Right.
See, if you could follow it, if it belonged to somebody else, then you're probably okay.
Then states change their health directives over time. Are most states respectful of the person's wishes?
No. And states, you know, I call it, you know, there's a saying under the law abhors a vacuum. So whenever right. we have a sad case like Karen Ann Quinlan or Nancy Beth Kruzan or Teresa Marie Schiavo, the lawmakers, and really that's us, but the lawmakers come rushing in to fill the vacuum and right. try to make laws so these bad things don't happen to good people. But the thing of it is, when you try to make laws that fit everyone, they often fit no one. Most laws in the United States were made 30 to 40 years ago. Do you think maybe we've had some advances in medical care? I mean, right. so many of the life-extending options we have, not life-prolonging, not like ventilation, but, you know, dialysis and these high-test antibiotics and all the things we have, they didn't even exist when these laws were made. They weren't even an issue because they didn't exist. So laws don't keep up with advancements, number one. Doctors aren't lawyers, for the most part. So they're asked to look at a legal document and say, gee, I wonder what this person wanted. So that doesn't work. Usually the advance directive isn't really what the person wanted anyway, and they didn't even understand it when they signed it. So what are we looking at? What are we left? Our proxy. Our proxy is the most important. And I encourage people to get that written appointment, Catherine, because then there isn't a question of, well, I know you think of her like a sister, but she's a sister-in-law, and that's not recognized under our law. So right. if somebody is a trusted person that knows what you want and they will stand up for you like you did for Georgie and like my 2% club will for me, you know, I mean, Katie bar the door if my right. team of advocates has to help me, then get it in writing and appoint that proxy and have the conversation, and then you're protected. Then you don't have to worry about whether or not right. the law protects you or the doctors respect you because you've got a strong advocate.
Right. My only concern is what happens if you do all of that, what happens if we're in a Katrina kind of situation and your 2% club is overwhelmed and swamped just like you.
Well, absolutely, and you can't prepare for every contingency. I always right. tell people have a proxy and an alternate proxy because often, well, certainly for married couples, they will name their spouse, and if it were to be an accident or something, yes, your number one substitute decision maker might be in as bad a shape as you are. So right. always have an alternate. But, yeah, it's impossible to address every situation.
Right.
But the thing people need to remember, too, is whatever is done medically can be reversed. And when I don't mean the procedure can be reversed, but your permission can be reversed.
Right.
So a doctor right. told me not long ago, he said, you know, people will come rushing into the emergency room the next morning and they go, my mom never wanted a ventilator. I can't believe you got my mom on a ventilator. And the doctor says, I just look at him and say, well, first of all, you weren't here last night. And your mom was in a crisis and we did what we needed to do to save her. Now, let's sit down and talk about our options because we right. can try this for a time-limited trial, and then you most definitely can make a decision to remove that ventilator. So you always right. have the option to stop a procedure that's already been started.
Right. Okay, last question. I've seen a certificate of cremation used What does it take with a cremation certificate to get a death certificate? Or what does it take with a cremation to get a death certificate?
Well, not my. I wouldn't call that my area of expertise. Again, that's going to be different in every single state, because
right.
we actually have these really weird rules across the United States of who even has authority to decide if you're going to be cremated, even if that's what everybody knows you wanted. Different
right.
laws have states have different rules about who can actually make that decision. A death certificate would be done before a cremation. But after the
right.
cremation would be too late. So, yeah, a
right.
death certificate is always going to be produced. And, you know, people dying in hospice, hospice has the authority to issue those death certificates without, you know, normally an unattended death requires an autopsy. But, of course, in hospice is the great exception to that. But, yes, there would always be a death certificate before a body was allowed to be disposed of. So,
right. So if someone dies at home, it's required to do an autopsy in some states?
No, if you died at home and you were not under hospice care and they could not very easily determine what the cause of death was, then yes, it would, most laws would require an autopsy because they would want to make sure that there wasn't any kind of foul play. I mean, if someone's just found dead in their home, chances
right.
are there's going to be an autopsy. There's certainly going to be a preliminary investigation by an ME to make sure that it was natural causes. But if you're enrolled in a hospice program, you call the hospice doctor and you say, Mom passed away, the hospice doctor does not need to come and examine the body. They just write the certificate because everybody knows that that person was dying.
Well, I'll tell you, Joe Klein, if you hang around listening to you and me, you will not be shy about talking about death anymore.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, that's the way it should be, because I got to tell you, I did a couple months ago, I'll just tell you quickly, I just decided I had a responsibility to do this. I have completely planned my funeral, and actually it was kind of fun. Sorry, I'm going to miss it, because, you know, I thought ahead of those things. What do I want to leave those people with? What do I want those people to feel like when they leave this event?
I just disagree with you, because everybody that I really loved who I went to the funeral, you know, I've had a couple of great people who died and went to they stick around for the funeral. Georgie was there
oh.
at the funeral. She left in the middle. I'll never forget it. So I think folks hang around in the spirit for a couple of days and most
I'm
of them come
when I say
the
I'm not going to be there. Trust me, Catherine, I'm going to be
You'll
there.
You'll be there.
I'll be there. But it was a very interesting process for me
uh-huh.
to pick the music and the readings and the message that, and I wanted people to feel good when they left. So I had to think really hard, what's the last song I want them to hear? And what kind
uh-huh.
of music do I want to have? It was really an interesting experience. I'd love to do a workshop on that sometime, because it was really... It was really cathartic. It was very interesting. And the other thing
uh-huh.
is I want people to stop and think, what a burden to put on your loved ones. They're in the midst of trying to get work through the fact that you've died. Now they have to plan this huge party and wonder what you wanted and which you want this or which you want that. I've done all that now. And I know my friends are going to appreciate that when the time comes, that all they have to do is plug in the CD and, you know, fill in the date after the dash.
Okay, well, I confess I haven't even thought about that. So.
Well, I encourage you to
You're
do that.
You're way ahead of me.
But it
okay,
was,
Joe.
It was fun to do that. I know it sounds strange, but, you know,
given the work that you do, particularly on the ethical will, it makes total sense. So before we go, if you could just remind everyone of your books, including your new one on healthcare literacy and your website, how do we find you? How do we get a hold of you? How do we get your books?
Okay. Well, everything you can access through my website. So you can go to Amazon, but you can go through the website as well, which is Joe, Klein, KLINE.net. Go there. My book, you know, of course, because you've always been so supportive of my writing. I first wrote about advanced directives in 2006. I updated that in 2015. So the Practical Guide to Healthcare Advanced Directives came out in 2015. And then my most recent one just this year is the 60-Minute Guide to health literacy, a common sense approach to informed medical decision making. And what I really do is hit the top areas that you need to know about ahead of time and think about and be ready, do a little paperwork, and you really will be a much more informed patient and you're ready to be a decision maker for yourself
right.
or for a loved one.
If you don't have a healthcare directive, you need to go to Joe's website and get the forms, get the documents, and start planning. It's just a remarkable thing to do, and you might as well just dive in and start learning how to do it. We're all going to have to. So,
yeah, I really think this is what I say is, you know, healthcare is a challenging journey, managing healthcare for yourself or a loved one, and I think being health literate really is like having a roadmap.
It's funny. When I first moved to Tennessee, I went to see the original homestead. My ancestors came to Tennessee from the East Coast, trying to get away from the Civil War. Some went to Texas. They got far enough, but some came to Tennessee, and it was a log cabin with no windows, no running water, and a dirt floor. And it was just a one-room cabin, and 10 people lived in it through the winter. And I took one look at that, and I said, you know, I was right in the middle of the litigation, so it was very, you know, sort of an extreme survival experience. And I said, what am I complaining about?
Yeah.
And it was when I first left, I gave up my health care insurance, because I thought, you know, my ancestors have made it for, you know, centuries and centuries without healthcare insurance, you know. So, but what it made me realize is the reason it's complicated and the reason we all have to do the kind of things we're talking about is because we have just, you know, incredible blessings of,
yes.
if you look at what the healthcare system offers, it's just amazing. It's fabulous. My grandfather started a clinic that became the first hospital in Jackson, Tennessee, and he was able, working with another relative who was in the state legislature, to get authorization to first introduce penicillin to Tennessee.
Wow.
Well, now we take antibiotics for granted, but remember the world without them. So
when you look at the medical devices and procedures that we've only had for about the last 20 years, it's mind-boggling. It's the MRI and the CAT scan and the dialysis, the things that we just feel like they've always been there. And they really have not been. The advances are leaps and bounds now, and it's
right.
tough
so
to
we,
keep up with it.
We've become a bit of a sarcastic culture, and so I just want to recognize, you know, whether it's the traditional healthcare system or the what's now happening with natural healthcare or the hospice system, you know, we have incredible blessings that most people around the world would just, you know, give anything for. And so,
yes, we do.
Yeah,
and with those blessings come great responsibilities, and I think
right.
that's the crossroads that we are at.
Right, and we're not gonna jump. I call it jump the curve, but in your case, I'm gonna call it jump the wall. we're not gonna jump the wall and take advantage of all these blessings without really taking that responsibility. And I agree with you. You have to help the people who will take responsibility. You can't
mm-hmm.
help the ones who won't.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that way.
People should not hesitate to talk to their providers about this too.
Exactly.
And talk about
right.
their concerns, because I think often we don't give our providers, our healthcare providers, credit for the fact that we understand there's only so much they can do. And we want
right.
to give them permission to give us bad news and tell us when it's time to start thinking about care rather than cure.
Right. Exactly. Okay. Well, Joe Klein, you're the best. Thank you so
Catherine,
much for joining us on the Salerno Report.
Always a pleasure. such a privilege for me to be able to talk to you and to address your audience, who are so engaged and so sophisticated, and a joy to be with you again.
They take responsibility. They're unbelievable.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, they do. Okay, you have a great day. Bye.
You too. Thanks so much.